Good afternoon, all, and thanks for making it to this place, to this conference room, rather than the slot machines below. So I really appreciate that. My name is Jay Haridas, and I'm a software development lead in the Windows Azure Storage team. And today I'll be talking about Windows Azure Storage. We've done a similar talk in most of the conferences, and one of the reasons why we kind of go over the basics a lot is because Windows Azure Storage is a scalable system. Especially the Azure table, it's a NoSQL database system, and we want to make sure that everybody groks what the design principles should be when you're designing on top of Windows Azure Storage system and what makes it scale, right? And that's one of the reasons why we keep repeating this talk. But one of the things which I want to do this time is actually show some code. So I have some demos out here for blobs, for tables. For Q, I didn't have enough time to get it done, but hopefully in the next presentation, I would surely have some Q demos too. And so I'll be briefly going over those. So I'll start off with Windows Azure Storage, the basic stuff, right? We don't want to scare away folks kind of saying, hey, this is scale, and you need to think about partitions and stuff like that when you're designing something that does not require scale, right? So there are two types of applications: applications that need to scale, needs to auto scale, and there are applications where you're saying that, hey, I just need to move this to the cloud so that I don't need any more servers. I don't have to manage anything else. Like every time a disk failure, I need to go and do something, change the disk or something of that sort. So I don't need any of those maintenance headaches. So I just want to move my small app. I get about maybe 50 requests per second. And that's about it, or 100 requests per second, or whatever, right? Throw a number out there. But it does not need to scale to an extent of where it needs a cloud storage system, right? So we'll cover both aspects of it. I'll start off with this simple thing. What is Windows Azure Storage? If you need to store a blob, what do you need to do? If you want to download a blob, what do you need to do? And then I'll get into the more scaling piece as such, where I start talking about partitioning and scalability, what each one needs to understand and what you need to do to make sure that your applications scale. So I'll go over those best practices out there, and then I'll take any questions. So right to basics, what is Windows Azure Storage? It's a scalable, durable, and highly available cloud storage system. Great. What does that mean? So you can start storing your data into the cloud, and it's a utility billing service, which means you get billed only for what you use. You get billed for transactions, you get billed for network bandwidth if it is outside a data center, if the communication channel is outside a data center, or rather your region. And the other thing is you pay for capacity, right? And those are the things that you pay for, but it's pay for what you use. It's not a fixed price where you say, okay, I'm going to pay X dollars and I can do whatever I need to. It's a utility service. If you don't use our services, you don't have to pay, right? And obviously, I mean, we have to provide a lot of abstractions because one thing does not fit all, right? So we have blobs. So when you want to start storing your files to the cloud storage system and you want to associate some metadata to it, some attributes, you use your blob storage system, right? This is unstructured data that you want to store into the cloud. And then we provide drives. Drives provides a durable NTFS volume for your applications that are running in the Windows Azure Cloud. It's not available when you're running it on your local node or your node in your premises, but it's available when you're running in the cloud, right? So it's a durable NTFS volume, and the reason it's here out here is because drives are built over something called page blobs, and I'll go over a few things about drives too. Tables. Tables provide structured storage. It's a schemaless, it's a NoSQL database system, and where you start storing entities, which is analogous to your rows in a relational database system, and you can put data and get data at scale. Queues provides a reliable storage for messages. These messages can be used to kind of communicate between two applications, so you decouple your applications by making it communicate via a queue message. So one application puts messages, and the other application, or what we call the worker role, which is going to work on those messages or processors, are going to retrieve that message and do whatever it needs to do according to the message that it retrieved. So Queue supports that. So we have these various abstractions, and let's go over the basic concept back again. So what do you need to do? Fine, you have four abstractions, but what do you need to do? First, you need to have a cloud storage account. When you go to the portal, sign up, and you get an account, once you get an account, you can start creating these containers for various abstractions. For blobs, it's called container. For entities, it's called table. And for messages, it's queue. So you create these containers for your objects, and then you start creating the actual objects, like blobs, entities, and messages. Each service has its own URL. It's account.blob.co.windows.net for accessing your blobs. For tables, it's .table.co.windows.net, and queue, it's similar. So all these are like C names to your actual web for the service. So getting again into the, what is Windows Azure Blobs, right? It provides a highly scalable, durable, available system for you to start storing files, and you can associate metadata along with your files. So that's what we described it as. In addition, there are no limits of how many containers you can create or how many blobs you can create. There's only one account limit as to 100 terabytes per account. That storage limit is out there, but there are no but you can create multiple accounts, right, and start using the storage system. You can upload, download blobs. Obviously, we need a way to for you to upload and download the blobs, but in addition, we allow range reads. We allow conditional operations like if match, like if you want to update a blob only if it matches, or if not match, or if not modified since, you want to retrieve the blob only if it has not been modified. So all those conditional headers we provide. In addition, there are some sharing scenarios out here. The couple of sharing scenarios are you can make your container public. When you make your container public, you provide read-only access to all your users. In addition, there is something called shared access signature. It's a pre-authenticated URL, and I'll cover into much details through a demo as to where these things are useful. But the shared access signature is basically where it is a pre-authenticated URL, and you have to share that URL with the folks that you want to share this with. For example, this can be thought of being used in an office where you don't want certain docs to be accessed by other departments. So you can only give this URL to a particular department, right? So shared access signature allows you to share your blobs with certain group of folks because it's a pre-authenticated URL. So let's start off with the demo out here. It's a simple demo. And so what I have in here is I've pre-logged in. I'm going to concentrate. I'm not an ASP.NET guy. For me, this is awesome, right? Because this is the best ASP.NET thing that I've ever developed because the rest of them really sucked. And that's one of the reasons why I'm in the backend store where I don't have to write any UI. So I really apologize upfront for all the ugly UI out here. But this is my drive where I start storing pictures and movies, right? So how do you, so I want to upload a blob. You can go here. And let's say I want to upload the demo blob. And I'm going to call it live. And I'm going to upload the blob. So meanwhile, when this is happening, what I want to show is, I'm hoping my connection is live. Right? It's completed out there. But what I wanted to also show is, what did it do behind the scenes? I'm running Wireshark, and I want to see what was transferred, right? How did our request look like? So I'm going to restart this again. And when I go to my files, which shows now the live demo file should have been uploaded out there, movies live. So this is what I did to get a listing of all the blobs in my container. I'm going to do this. And it shows you exactly what was transferred, right? A bunch of things that you can easily understand, a lot of XML. Just to give you a look, the reason I'm explaining this is a lot of times what happens is folks have either a lousy connection or they have a kind of a expected error, like they're trying to get a container which does not exist, or they're trying to create a container and it gives a conflict error and stuff like that. This is an easy way to figure out what your application is doing. There are tools like Fiddler, Wireshark, Netmon. All these tools are great. And I'm not sure, I mean, please raise your hand if anybody has used these tools out here and I can stop talking about it. But these are the tools that you can use to kind of trace what's happening. And to go over this code out here, I'm going to put a debug statement so that we can go through the upload code. And bear with me. So let me go back again. Take this. I'm going to just take one of the stuff. I'm going to call it live again. And I'm going to upload it to my pictures album and just say upload. So if you look at the code, it's very simple out here. I need to create a blob client. I have an account. I create a blob client. You can ignore this piece of statement, which is going to come back again. We have two kinds of blobs, block blob and page blob, but I didn't use anything of that sort out here. I get the container reference, and this is not made any call over the wire. I then do a get blob reference, which is again not done any call. It's not issued any call over the wire. And then I get the content type from the folder type, which I selected, and it's picture, so it sets the right content type. In addition, what I have used is size-based timeout. What you will see is the storage client always uses a default timeout of 90 seconds. I'm using the Windows Azure storage client that ships with the SDK. It uses a default of 90 seconds. This may not be sufficient if you're uploading a 20 megabyte blob on a very, very slow connection, right? So it may not be sufficient enough at all. So what I have done here is basically based on the size, I say, hey, maybe I'm getting just less than 1 megabyte per second. So I'm going to set my timeout to something really large. Out here, I set it to, about 2 minutes, 1 minute and 50 seconds. So this is something, again, a best practice to do. Set your timeout based on the size of the blob. And then I just call blob.uploadFromStream. The input stream is from the file upload control that I got, and that's about it. That's the only thing that I had to do to upload a blob, right? Similarly, to download the blob, all you need to do is I get the size-based timeout again and then use download to stream, and I give the target stream if I need to download it. So that's about it. This uploading and downloading of a blob is as simple as this, right? So now let's continue with the slides, and I'll get back to this demo again to show the other concepts like block upload and the concepts of sharing. So I said there are two kinds of blobs, block blobs and page blobs. So block blobs is targeted at streaming workloads. So each blob consists of a sequence of blocks. You can think of this blob being made of a sequence. The block length itself, you determine what the length is. It can be up to 4 megabytes, right? And it's a two-phase commit. you start writing these blocks. Once you finish writing these blocks, you then commit it. This is a nice way, for example, for logging, right? You can start writing to your blocks. You don't have to commit. You upload your block every few minutes, maybe. And then every 10 minutes you want to create a log file, you can just commit the blob. So you've written a bunch of blocks and then committed it. It's a two-phase commit. So, and what this provides is an efficient retry. And the next slide will go into more details about that. You can upload these blocks in any order you want. And it's while committing, you decide what is the order of the blocks that form the blob. So the two-phase commit gives you this kind of advantage of doing this parallel uploads. And even if one fails, you can retry and upload it finally and then commit the blob once all the blocks have made it to the cloud. The size limit for a block blob is 200 gigabytes per blob. So this is just an animation that shows this. File has a variable size blocks. It doesn't have to be of the same length. The block IDs, however, each block has an ID. All the block IDs have to be of the same length, right? So I start uploading these blocks. The blob has not been committed yet. You cannot retrieve anything yet. Block 3 has been uploaded. Let's assume block 1 failed for some reason. I retry the failed block. And then when you commit, you decide what the sequence of the blocks are. So what about page blobs? So page blobs are targeted at random write workloads. So in a page blob, when you create the page blob, you'd give it a size, right? And the size can be up to 1 terabyte. So once you're given the size, you have not uploaded anything into the blob yet, but there is this size that has been reserved for this blob. And then you start writing pages. Pages are 512 bytes in size. You can write up to 4 megabytes in one, so multiple pages in a single request, up to 4 megabytes. But the write always has to be aligned at a 512 byte boundary, right? Range reads are always possible in both the blobs, so it doesn't matter if your range. We keep getting this question: hey, I have range reads. What should I use? Is it page blob? It doesn't matter. You can use page blob or block blob. So for range reads, it does not matter. It's when you want to write to a particular position and override this, and you don't want this two-phase commit, that's when this is useful. The page blobs are really useful out there. And drives uses it because of that, right? Because drives always writes to a particular position, and that's why Windows Azure Drive is built on page blob. And of course, pages that do not have the data, when you write pages, if you haven't written, like when you create the blob, the size has been reserved. If you try to get this blob, you'll just get a terabyte of zeros if your initial size is 1 terabyte, right? So there are some APIs out there to get page ranges and start reading it efficiently. So again, write 5K bytes. And then I want to clear 2K bytes starting at offset 1K. So when I do a clear page, I can always clear pages up to 4 MB in one request. I can overwrite any of the pages, and it just overwrites the data in place in that particular location. And I can also truncate the blob by setting the max size to less than what I had initially decided. So let's go to this interesting scenario of sharing your files, right? When you most of the scenarios are built for sharing. At least most of the applications in the cloud are built for sharing. So how do you share your files as such? Unless you're talking about like a Dropbox kind of application, but even those applications may come up with some social scenarios where you want to start sharing and stuff like that, right? So let's go over what are the various ways you can share a blob today. So every blob request by default has to be signed. It has to be authenticated, right? By default, if you have not done anything to your containers, by default, everything has to be authenticated. When you want to share your files, there are a couple of ways, which I kind of briefly went over. You can make your container public, in which case the blob URL can just be given to your users and they can access it. It's read-only access, by the way. You cannot write to that blob. You have only read-only access when the container is made public. And then you have the shared access signature, which is more powerful. It's powerful because you decide whom you want to share it with. It's a pre-authenticated URL, and we'll go through the demo quickly. but it's a pre-authenticated URL, and you decide whom you want to share with. In addition, you can give various permissions, like, for example, delete blob, write blobs, or read or listing, and things like that. So you can give all these permissions to your users, right? There are two ways to do shared access signature, one in which all this information like start time, expiry time, and what kind of permissions, everything is embedded in the URL. And you sign it using your token, right? Your secret key, which you get when you create an account, you sign it using that. And once you get that token, you give that signed URL to your users, right? The second way is, instead of storing all the parameters in the URL as query parameters, you can create an access policy. The access policy will contain all the parameters now, like start time, end time, what kind of permissions. And now you use that access policy in the URL instead. What's the advantage? If you've given this URL out with incorrect permissions, you can revoke it. You can go to the container access and change the access policy saying, hey, sorry, I didn't mean to give the delete access. I just meant to give the read access. Whereas if all the parameters are in the URL itself and you sign it, the max expiry time is 1 hour. For that 1 hour, you cannot revoke that access that you've given out. Right? So let's go back to the second demo, which is the same application. So I have decided to share my blobs with everyone. And I also said, hey, I might want to just share a few things. And it doesn't make sense out here, right? Because if it's public, I don't need this. So I'm just going to submit. And when I go to my files, I want to download this particular application, right? So I'm going to start off. Just a minute. So this is a priceless video that we captured yesterday of Steve Marks juggling. I knew he juggles conferences, but I never knew he was good at it. So this is a public container, right? So everybody gets to see.
Oh boy.
Awesome.
That's right.
At
Max. Oh boy.
Awesome.
Right?
That's right.
In repeat mode. So this is a public container. And I didn't have to sign the URL. I could just go to Windows Media Player, give the URL, and I could access it. So this is public. So I had read-only access. Let me go back and say, hey, sorry, I didn't mean to give public access, but I want to give only shared access signature. And I hope it's, yeah. It cannot access it anymore because I made it shared. I made it only possible to access it via shared access, right? However, when I go here, if you look at this link, look at that URL out there. That's how your shared access signature looks. So you have SR equal to B, which means my resource that I'm trying to share is a blob. SI is equal to read. This is the access policy that I have created on the container, and this is an identifier. So all the permissions and start date, expiry time, everything is on my container. And then that's the token that I got by signing this using my account key, right? And I give this URL. Whoever has access to this URL can now access it. And this is the particular link that I have. I'm going to copy a shortcut to this. And now, go back here.
Oh boy.
Awesome.
That's right.
Okay? So that's shared access signature as such. And let's just look at the code out here now. So let's first look at what I did to set the container ACL, right? Depending on the permission, if I had to give public access, I get the container, I create a permissions object, I decide whether it's a public container or not. I then figure out if I need to create a read access URL, and then I create a shared policy. I give it only read permission, and I never want to make this end. 100 years, hopefully we'll all be there to see it. And then there are shared access policies, right? I set the shared access policy name as read out here, so this is basically read. And I set that policy as one of the policies that I want to set on the container. I do similar things for write access if I want to give write access to someone. And I set that also on the permissions if it needs to be. And then I call set permissions with that. So this is that simple code out here which I can use to set container ACLs, right? I can always go and change it back if I've given out the wrong ACL. In addition, if I want to get the SaaS URL, this one gets me a shared access signature for read permissions, right? And expiry minute of 30 minutes. I cannot give more than six. I cannot I can't keep it unlimited. I have to give an expiry for it. So I give an expiry for it of 30 minutes, and then I get the shared access signature. Right? If I hadn't used the policy name, I would have been forced to give this as 1 minute. Oh, sorry, 1 hour, right? So this is a code which is looking at shared access signatures. For this one, I've used the URL that I've used is basically a shared access signature with everything embedded in the URL. So when I say download, what I've done is I create a shared access signature with all the parameters embedded in the URI as such. When I go to the share it link, I use the policy to kind of give me a URL for the shared access signature. So these are two different kinds of shared accesses that I've kind of shown out here. So heading back, the next thing I would like to talk about is snapshots. What is a snapshot? It's a point-in-time backup of your blob. It's a read-only copy. You cannot write to snapshots, but it's a point-in-time. And it's useful because now you can start creating these various versions. And with these various versions, whenever you create a snapshot, you get these versions. You can always go back to a particular version that you want to choose by just copying it back over to the base blob, right? So the other good part about snapshots is that you get charged only for the blocks and pages that have not been reused, right? So you get charged only once if you've reused your blocks and pages. And I'll go over an elaborate example as to what you get charged for again. But one of the things to note is to get this reuse, you need to use the block-level APIs and the page-level API, so write pages or write blocks, put blocks basically, and then put block lists to commit it to get this reuse back, right? And bear with me out here. The next slide kind of drills into this example more. Like I said, you can always restore your snapshots by doing a copy blob over your base blob, and you can remember to always clean up your snapshots. There's no fixed limit of snapshots that are happening, so every time you call a snapshot, a version appears for you, and it's up to the user to kind of delete these snapshots or clear these snapshots. So what does unique mean? So let's go with this block blob example. I have two blocks, A and ID 1 and ID 2. So I added these two blocks, and I've committed the blob. I then take a snapshot of it. So when I take a snapshot, I get a snapshot, a point-in-time snapshot, and the snapshot name is the same as the blob, the base blob, except that it has the time suffixed as a query parameter to it. And what are you charged for out here? You're only charged for the two blocks of A, of the base blob, ID 1 and ID 2. So you get charged only for those two particular blocks. You're not being charged for the snapshot, right? So let's go ahead and I added one more block, and I committed the block. And now I have three blocks in my blob, and I get charged only for the three blocks, A, B, B, and the CCC, the ID 1, 2, 3 of the base blob, right? The snapshot is still free. I created one more snapshot. So it creates a point-in-time snapshot of this particular base blob. And I still get charged only for the three blocks of the base blob. I've reused the block A in that snapshot. I've reused the block BB in both the snapshots, actually A and BB. And the third block is being reused in the snapshot out here. So I'm only being charged for three blocks. So these are the three blobs that I have in my account now, two snapshots and one base blob, right? Let's assume that I've updated block ID 1, again with the same data, exactly the same data. And the reason I'm going through this example is to kind of make it clear that there's no dedupe happening on our end, right? So you're writing exactly the same data into block ID 1, and you commit the blob. Now what you get charged for is the base blobs, ID 1, ID 2, and ID 3, so the three blocks. And then once for the snapshot of block A, because that's a different block, right? So there's no dedupe happening out here, and you're getting charged for all these blocks. These blocks are unique blocks now. And when I take a snapshot, however, you get the exact snapshot. So now I have four blobs in my account, snapshot 1, 2, and 3. And all I'm being charged for is ID 1 in the base blob, ID 1 in the snapshot, and then ID 2 and ID 3 in the base blob back again. So the four blocks, that's what I'm being charged for. So snapshots is a nice way of getting this version. And when you start reusing your blocks, when you upload your blob to your base blob, when you reuse the blocks using block upload or page upload, you only pay for what has changed. So a thing to note out there is the storage client library has upload file, upload text, upload from stream, and upload byte array. All this would actually rewrite all the blocks in your blob. So now you don't get any reuse. So if I go ahead and upload the same blob back again using upload file or upload text, I've lost the reuse because now all these blocks are different. I've rewritten those blocks, right? So that's one of the things that you need to remember. You're charged for the entire snapshot and the base blob now, because the old snapshots and the base blob, because the blocks are different. So let's quickly go over the best practices. Use parallel block upload, and that's one of the things that I didn't go through, and let me go through that example afterwards. Basically, where instead of uploading one block at a time, you can upload parallelly multiple blocks and then commit it. So that's a good thing. And then client library uses a default of 90-second timeout. So you have to use size-based timeout. People have kind of been impacted by this multiple times where they come back and say, hey, you know what? It's never my upload or my download is never completing on a slow connection, and that's because of the 90-second timeout. Snapshots, again, like I said, use block or page upload methods. rather than upload the entire blob to get the reuse. And remember to clear your snapshots. Shared access signature, there's container level, and there's a pre-authenticated URL with everything embedded in the URL. Use the container level because you can kind of revoke your access because you can go and change the policy on your container at any point. Create new containers for blobs like log files that have retention period, right? So if you're writing your log files, for example, and you have a retention period of 30 days for a month, basically, create a new container each month. That's easier now to delete in one request to delete a month container rather than each file. You get charged per request. So now you're issuing a request per log file rather than deleting a container. So that's one of the things that is always good to follow. And container recreation, yes, are bad. We don't allow you to recreate containers at this point until the garbage collection has taken place, right? So if you have deleted the container and you try to create the container with the same name immediately, it might fail, or rather most, unless it has not much data. But if it's a log file with zillions of logs in it, it takes time for garbage collection, and that's the reason why we say, hey, until we fix this, think about your scenario where if you can use a versioned container name instead. So create a new container name each time rather than recreating the same container name. And we will be fixing this. So Windows Azure Drive, it provides a durable NTFS volume for your applications running in the cloud, right? In Windows Azure Cloud. So what are the advantages, obviously? It has NTFS API, so you can easily move your legacy applications today rather than rewriting them for the cloud. You can upload it to the cloud and make it run out there and use a Windows Azure Drive to get the disk access. And all the writes that are unbuffered and flushed are made durable because this drive is nothing but it's an NTFS VHD, a fixed VHD, designed as a page blob. So your page blob is kind of loaded as a VHD drive. All your writes are happening to the page blob, and that's how it's durable. When your application starts up, you mount the page, you mount your VM, or rather you mount your Azure Drive as such, and then once you mount your drive, you get your NTFS APIs to kind of store, read and write to that particular drive. We have some caching in the Azure Drive that kind of caches your data. So to reduce the number of hits to storage system itself, that's there. But you can assume that all the flushed, unbuffered writes will be made durable. So that's one of the advantages of Windows Azure Drive. So if anything happens to your application, you can mount this Azure Drive in another VM role or in your copy role, in your worker role, and then start off from where you left, right? A single VM can dynamically mount up to 16 drives today, but when you mount a drive for write access, only one drive kind of takes a lease on the page blob, and only one drive can have write access today. And of course, drives can be up to 1 terabyte. The obvious limit comes from the page blob, which has a 1 terabyte limit. So Azure Table. So provide massively scalable, durable tables. It's a NoSQL system. It's not a relational database system as such. It doesn't have any relational capabilities. But I'll again go through a demo which shows how you can store multiple types, and it's a poor man's join kind of thing, and how you can kind of get your schema. So I have a demo for that. And it provides flexible schema, and that's the advantage that we make use of to kind of give this join capabilities so that you cluster all your data that you need to access at once together in a single table. There's no limit on number of entities or number of tables that you can create, and we have provided a familiar interface for you, which is WCF Data Services. And by going with WCF Data Services, what we've basically done is go with the REST OData protocol. So you have the OData access to Windows Azure Tables. So let's look at a simple demo here. So it's a video rental store where there are users, And when the user, whenever I check out a video, I want to kind of increment the number of movies checked out, and I also give the user a credit, right? So I can start. Right? So I have checked out our movie here. And to see what it actually what happens behind the scene, again, once you have a cloud storage account, you have to get your table context. I'm creating a new table context each time. And if you go to this piece of code, I basically create a new storage context each time, and that's one of the best practices, right? From there on, what I do is I need to get my rental account information. And this is stored, which means I need to go and get a row, right? Because it could have changed meanwhile. So what I do is a query. I do an ignore resource not found exception so that if for whatever reason that resource does not exist, because I'm addressing this resource in this query, if you look at it, from entity in context where I'm creating a query, this is a link query, and raise your hand if anybody has already done link queries out here. Oh, great. So I'm just quickly going to go through this just for the folks who haven't worked with it. So you create a query on the table. So this is your table name in my constant file. And I'm looking for where my partition key is my account name, and the row key is account. So my row key, I'm not using it much when I'm storing my account information. It's always fixed. It's just account and with a colon out there at the end, right? And I'll go through this, the reason why I do this very soon. But this is what I've done here. My schema is my user information has username, right? Which is my partition key. So I'm partitioning based on my user data, my username or user account name, right? And when I execute this query, what I get from the system is how many movies I have checked out until now, my credits, the username that I was using, right? So this is the three pieces of information that I needed to kind of check out a movie. And the reason I needed that is because I need to update the credits and the number of movies currently checked out. I create a rental entity, which is the movie name that I've checked out, which is Cloud Power 2, I guess. Right? And the username is still my account name. I add the object into my context. I update the entity that I retrieved, the account entity, I'm updating that. And I call update object to let WCF data service context know that I'm updating this entity. And then I call save changes with retries with a batch option. I can use batch option out here. If I'd left that batch, what would have happened is internally, WCF data services would have sent two requests out to the service, one for the new rental information and the second for the update of the account information, right? So it would have sent out two requests which are not related, two unrelated requests out, and even if one of them had failed, it means now my account information is kind of invalid, or if the rental information checkout fails, it means the information in my table is invalid. I've updated one row, but the other one has not succeeded, right? For that reason, I'm using batch. Batch gives me transactional semantics. So now I'm assured that if this call succeeds, my credits have been incremented, my checked out count has been incremented, and my rental information has been inserted into the table, right? So this gives me transactional semantics, and for this to happen, what I had to do was to make sure my partition key is always the username, right? It has to have the same partition key name. So we allow transactions on entities as long as it has the same partition key value. So I designed my schema such that my rental information and my account information had the same partition key, which is my account info. And it makes sense, right? Because this is this information is related to a particular account. So it makes sense to do that in terms of keeping the partition key the same. So what this also means now is, and I'm going to go through this once more. I'll just go quickly through this particular thing. So I got my second movie, or rather the movie which I've rented out. So all this is great in terms of entity group transaction. It gave me this transactional capabilities that I've used. I've got 11 credits. It incremented the number of movies to 4 now. So what we've seen now is we updated an object, and we queried for an object, a point in time query where I've used the partition key and row key to get the account information out, and then use entity group transaction to update it, right? So let's assume I want to return a given movie. It's the same thing now that I'm doing. When I return a movie, my movies checked out has to be decremented, and this movie needs to go. Right? I do the same thing. I get this account information, I update it and add it to that context, I delete the movie, whichever movie I return, which is Cloud Power out there, I delete that entity on the same context, and I then use batch operation to send a single entity group transaction to the cloud, and it's a transactional semantics that I get. And all this is because my schema, which we can go over. So my rental entity, I use the same thing as the username. My partition key, I'm setting it to the exactly the same stuff. This is a class. This is my kind of the plain old C# object that I'm using to reflect the entity that I'm storing into the cloud. So I derive it from table service entity, and this is not a must. What table service entity all does is it gives you a partition key and row key. That's about it, right? So if I had actually declared partition key and row key as public properties out here, that should have sufficed. But I derived it from table service entity. In my setter of my username, I also set the partition key to the same value. Now, this is the fun part. I'm storing account information and the rental information in the same table, right? And for that, I've just used a utility that I have access to out here. There are various utilities that you can use, but I've just executed a query on my table, and it shows there's account information and my rental information all in a single table. And the way I've done that is I've used row key to differentiate. My row key for my account information is always the static account colon, so that if I want to retrieve just the account information, I can always do that, right? My username is my account name, and row key is equal to account colon. And this is my rental information where I've just prefixed it with rental colon. So you can think of this prefix that I've added to both the rows as my row type. So that's my row type that kind of differentiates the two records. And this is, so when you just execute a query which says account name is equal to J, it's just going to retrieve all my records in one, account and my rental information. So this is like a join now, right? In a relational database system, you would have kept this in two different tables. What I did is denormalize them, collated them together in a single table. It's a flexible schema, so I have access to that. And I've stored both the rows in there. So when I retrieve this information, what I do is I use a union class, but I use that only for my data access, right? I use a union class with all the properties, and then figure out which is the account information and which is the rental information based on that prefix for the row key. And I convert it back to my data model so that my application does not have to deal with this muck of all the properties for account and rental, right? I don't need that class. So I can convert that easily into the appropriate classes. And that's what this does. So get all information, gets it only for the partition key, and let me just... Right? And if it is an account row, I create the account entity, which only has its own properties, and then for the rental, I just create a rental row and add it to a rental list, and I return both this information separately. So for my application layer, it doesn't have to deal with this union entity as such. And I don't have to muck with the XML or anything of that sort, reading entity, writing entity. I've used this. Having said that, we have a feature request on our that we've taken it out to kind of make this even more simpler, because OData allows you to kind of send the class name in the OData protocol as a term. So all this information is there. We need to do a few things to kind of enable this to make it much more simpler. But until then, you can always use this model to kind of get both the information out very easily. The next thing I would like to also cover is the query portion. So every entity has this partition key, right? And it's really important to know that that's your partition key and row key is your clustered index. So this is your clustered index in the Azure table. So let's figure out if I want to just get my entity, it took about 135 milliseconds. I'm pretty sure we can do better than that. Yeah, 69 milliseconds, because the RTT, which I'm seeing, is about 75 milliseconds through Wireshark, right? So this is what is happening out here. I got this particular entity. But what if I use, my account name is also a property. It's not only partition key, I have a property called account name. What if I didn't use partition key? Because OnKey used the partition key to query it. The query was basically where partition key is equal to my name out here, and row key is equal to the fixed string, which is account colon, right? So it did a point query, which is really efficient. It goes, looks up the B-tree, and gets to the row and returns the row back again. So that's really efficient. But what if I had not used my partition key? It's 264 milliseconds. I'm just going to keep executing this to figure out. Yeah. So what this is doing now is a query where I've said, get me all the rows where account name is equal to J. What this does is a table scan. I have about 12,000 rows approximately that I've populated into this table. It's going to go through every one of those rows now to figure out which account name has the value J and return that. Right? So I had these two choices with me, which is partition key or use the row key. Or use the non-key value. Obviously, the using the key value has advantages. It's a clustered index. It's a fast access lookup. The other thing which I wanted to mention out here is prefix search. So I see this particular entity out here, right? So there's an account name called Drew09999. What if I had just done a prefix? So I have about 2,000 rows for Drew. And I just did a query. And let's see if I got that row. It returned me 1,000 rows in about 2.83 seconds. And that row is missing, right? So let's just look at this again, and I need to capture. So if I do the on prefix back again, let's look at what happened there. So this is the information. I'm going to follow the TCP stream. The reason I didn't get the row is because the system returned me a continuation token because it returned 1,000 rows already. This is your continuation token that you need to take care of. The storage client library has APIs out there to take care of your continuation tokens. And the basic code to do that is use the cloud table query. On your link query, if you use cloud table query, it would go back and execute how many ever times it needs to using that continuation token to get rest of your result sets back. So in this particular example, this is how you would have done it. So you need to use cloud table query as table service query, and it would return all the information to you because the cloud table query handles continuation tokens, right? So this is your structured storage demo where there's pieces of code. I'm going to post this code in a few days on a storage team blog site, kind of giving all the best practices and things like that. But here's the thing. Use the cluster index in your query for performance. We saw the difference, right, from 60 milliseconds to about 250 milliseconds for a very small table, that too, right? The majority of the time is to transfer that OData data itself. Right, so it's easier for you to do a point query using the cluster index for your price zero scenarios. Limit large scans and expect continuation tokens for queries. We saw a continuation query continuation token out in our trace out there. There are various reasons why we return continuation tokens. There's a good blog by Steve Marks based on the continuation tokens. The other thing is entity group transaction batch to reduce costs. So there are two reasons why you might batch. A, to reduce your cost, right? So you have to design your schema so that the partition key is the same for all the things that you want to kind of upload or insert or update your data as such. In addition, you can also use it for your transactional semantics that you need, require. For example, the video rental demo needed a transactional semantics where I update the rental and the account information in one transaction, and that's where I use the entity group transaction. Do not reuse data service context across multiple logical operations. The reason is because it remembers your last previous action, and if there's a failure action, it's going to re-execute that. And I'm pretty sure a lot of people would have hit this particular issue the first time and then figured out, oops, I need to kind of dispose this data service context and create a new one because it's remembering, or I have to detach that particular object. So discard your data service context on failures. Add object and attach to can throw exceptions. We've had a lot of people kind of take dependency on these things of not throwing an exception, and WCF, .NET had an update and it started throwing exceptions. So you need to kind of expect these exceptions as such. Point query throws an exception if resource does not exist. So use ignore resource not found exception if it's a very valid scenario for you for not having that particular entity with you. Windows Azure queues are highly scalable, available, and reliable messaging system as such, where you can start storing your messages. A message can be up to 8 kilobytes in size. You can use this to kind of decouple your two components as such. Instead of kind of communicating with each other, you can start using messages to communicate. Programming semantics ensure that the message will be delivered at least once. So the reason is because it has this two-step again. You do a get message to get the message itself from the queue, and then once you process it, you delete the message. And the reason this is useful is because if your application, after receiving this message, if it crashes without processing it, there's a message that has gone lost without processing. So that's the reason we have this two-step semantics. And when you're retrieving the message, you give a visibility timeout, basically. So when you give this visibility timeout, what happens in the system is this message is not visible to anyone else until either you call delete or that timeout expires. So the next worker gets the message. So you can give a visibility timeout. Access is provided by REST out here. Best practices make message processing idempotent because your application could crash, a message could be redelivered because of the visibility timeout being expired. So various reasons why a message can appear back again. So make your message processing idempotent. Do not rely on the order because invisibility time can result in out of order delivery for your applications. Now, message size is 8 kilobytes in size. Use blobs or tables to store bigger data set, and you can use a key in the message whenever you have to exceed the 8 kilobytes. Use message count to dynamically increase or reduce workers. I mean, this is really one of the things that will be beneficial, right? So what you could, one of the things that we've been receiving is, hey, I keep polling this queue message, and I have no, I don't get a message at all, but I'm being charged for it, right? It's a request that is not receiving a, that is not retrieving a message because your queue does not have any more messages to process. But if you have about 20 worker roles out there spamming this queue with get messages, you're paying for this. You're paying for the compute to run the worker role and also for the transactional costs, right? So one of the good things you can do is you can dynamically reduce the worker roles. So there are service management APIs to kind of reduce your number of worker roles that you need to process and just retain one of them which polls every second or so or whatever your SLA is, right? We did some brief calculation. If you have just one thread hitting our messaging system for polling our messaging system, you pay about $2.67 in a month for that polling. As against, if you had a lot of workers, you would have had to pay for the compute for those workers and also for the transactions that they keep hitting the queue every second or every millisecond, right? So you can spawn more instances whenever you detect a backlog, and you can dynamically increase or reduce. So the queue count, message count is really helpful. Use DQ count to detect either poison messages, so messages that are not being deleted because it has some error in it. You can use your DQ count to see how many times it has appeared. The other thing that could happen because when you see a DQ count increase is because your visibility timeout is not much. It's very small, right? So you can start increasing the visibility timeout. You can have these config parameters for your visibility timeout and start increasing that when you detect that your DQ count is increasing. I'm way past it, so I'm just going to skip through the partitioning stuff very quickly. So know your scalability targets. So this is the most important stuff, right? Single blob partition, throughput up to 60 megabytes per second. Single queue and table partition up to 500 transactions, entities or messages. Remember, if you have an entity group transaction of 100 each, which is the limit for entity group transaction, if you have five of such, you've hit that 500 limit. Our storage account itself has an SLA of 99.9% availability. Our capacity is 100 terabytes, and transactions for a single account is 5,000 transactions. Again, messages, entities per second, and the bandwidth is up to 3 gigabits per second. So this gives you a picture. If you need to scale, you need to know what your partition keys are and partition it properly. If you're not hitting the limits at all, then you can keep everything in a single table if you want, like list of states, and it's being accessed very infrequently, right? Because my front ends are caching the list of states. For this, I don't have to kind of partition it by state name. I can just keep it in one particular table and just give access to it, and my front ends cache it, right? So these are the things which you need to know about your limits and about your application and its limits. And depending on that, you need to kind of design your scale. So understanding partitioning is the key to understanding how you scale your application. Every data object in our storage system has a partition key. And the partition key is unit of scale. So what does partition key mean? So all the objects that have the same value for the partition key are co-located and served by a single server, right? When I say co-located, I'm not talking about the disk space itself or where they are stored on the disk, but they are served by a single server as such at the partitioning layer. And I'm going to go through a quick animation after this. And our system load balance is based on these partitions now. It moves, whenever a system has to load balance, it'll move the entire, all the objects that have the same partition key, it's going to load balance based on those as a group of entities, right? And during this load balancing, you could get server busy. You could also get server busy because you're going above the limits maybe, right? And if a system cannot handle it, it is going to return server busy, and what we expect is that the applications will back off exponentially till the system recovers, right? So let's go and kind of look at what happens behind the scenes. So when a request comes in, it gets through a, you can think of a WIP, a load balancer. It gets to one of the front ends, and from the front end, it goes to the appropriate back end, which is serving that partition, right? It goes to the appropriate server, which is servicing that partition. As you see, each server has multiple partitions that it's serving today. And the loads can be different. If you feel that a single service is getting too many requests because it has all these hot partitions out there, a master system is going to recognize this. It's going to offload those partitions. It's going to do this load balancing out there. It's going to offload the partitions and then reassign them to the systems that have lower load. Right? So time between offload to reload is an order of a few seconds. Time to decide whether to load balance or not. We're never going to load balance on every spike. So the time to kind of load balance can be in order of minutes. And goal is to reassign a partition only if the system has to, right? So the partition key for your blob objects, it's the container name plus blob name. So every blob which has different names will, different container name or blob name will be in its own partition. So having said that, so it means that only a snapshot and its base blobs can be in the same partition, right? Because the blob name itself is a partition key. For a table, it's entity, the table name and the partition key value itself. For messages, it's a single queue. The queue name itself is a partition. So that's one of the reasons why if you need more than 500 requests per second, it's best to kind of go with multiple queues to kind of scale out. I spoke about all these limits, and this graph kind of defies that, right? Because on a single partition, which is before I kind of dwell into the numbers, this experiment was done on our LifeSite production using a single account. And what we did is we took compute nodes, and we ran our applications from there, which did single entity inserts. We used an extra large VM. We had 15 threads in each VM. And as you see, as we increased the number of VMs, the load increased too when I use multiple partitions. So the red line is successful inserts for multiple partition, and the green line is successful inserts for a single partition. As you see, a multiple partition, if I partition it well and if I'm hitting different partition keys, our system load balances and you get a higher throughput. A single partition is giving about 1,000 requests, and we said a single partition is 500 requests, entities per limit is the limit, right? Again, this is not a hard set limit, but the limit what we have provided out here is to give you a consistent feel for the application. If you go above these limits, and if a system has to load balance or if a system has to throttle someone because it's a shared system, then it's going to go and throttle users that are going above the limits. So for a consistent feel for your application, a consistent experience for your applications, it's best to kind of stay within those limits and you partition your data appropriately if you feel that you're going above a single partition limit. Similarly for GETs, a single partition is giving me about 3,000 requests per second, and on a multiple partition, I'm getting about close to 11,000 requests per second for a single point query. So this is way about the limits that we've, again, suggested, but for a consistent experience, stay within the limits of a single partition. The other thing that I would like to kind of go through is the append-only pattern that you need to kind of look out for, right? You can create new partition keys. You can start using new partition keys. But if you select, let's assume your timestamp as your partition key and you really have high throughput limits, that's not going to load balance. The reason is because a partitioning is a range-based partitioning system. So if you look at server A, it's serving that range of partitions, and server B is serving the rest of the ranges. Like, you can think of it as the last range. If you divide all your data set into ranges, which is sorted by partition key and row key, that's the range that you get, right? So as you get these requests, if you use your timestamp moves forward. Though you get new partition keys each time, all you're doing is an append-only pattern, and it's always going to server B. You're not using the different partitions in your system, right? The rest of it is cold data, which you've already inserted. So no matter how much we load balance, it's not going to help you out here. So append-only pattern is kind of bad. You should kind of append or prepend you should avoid it for high scale. It's fine if you're doing, if you're staying within the limits and our system can handle it, right? But if you're doing high scale and you expect to be load balanced, it's not going to help you out here. So just some takeaways out here. Blobs, that's for files and associating metadata with your files. Drives, it's a durable NTFS volume for Windows Azure applications. Tables is a structured storage. It's a NoSQL database system for Windows Azure. And queues is a reliable delivery of messages. We have a Windows Azure Storage Client Library. Some of the demos went through the Storage Client Library as such. So, and that's about it. I know we're way above the time limit, so I'm going to be at the Azure Storage booth. So if you have any questions, feel free to drop in and ask the questions.